Hello, I'm John Auerbach, president of Trust for America's Health. In partnership with Wellbeing Trust, we recently released a new brief in our Pain in the Nation series, which examines the growing and devastating toll of alcohol and drug misuse and suicide on our nation, and importantly, provides solutions that cut across communities and party lines to ensure everyone can thrive. This latest report focuses on the millennial generation, a generation that is at elevated risk itself, but also, if they haven't already, are beginning to have families, making them one of the most important groups when it comes to preventing future substance misuse. With me to discuss that report and the specific and actionable solutions that Trust for America's Health and Wellbeing Trust propose to save lives is my friend and colleague, Dr. Benjamin Miller, Chief Strategy Officer of Wellbeing Trust.
Thanks so much, John. Looking forward to our discussion today. This issue is vital, and these numbers are quite stunning and staggering. Just to give the listeners an idea, the new data suggests that deaths due to alcohol, drug misuse, and suicide have increased precipitously over the last two decades, including a 400% increase in drug-related deaths. And while there's not a segment of our society that isn't experiencing these crises in our nation, it appears that right now this is especially problematic for millennials. This is the folks that are about to have children, the folks in our communities that we probably work with. This is who we need to begin to talk about and who we need to focus on.
Well, I completely agree with you, Ben. And what I think is interesting is that with this age group, we've seen the trend of increases in deaths in these three causes, drug-related deaths, alcohol-related deaths, and suicides. And the numbers are pretty staggering, as you say. In the last 10 years, the drug-related deaths are up more than 100%. The alcohol-related deaths are up 69%, and suicides are up 35%. You know, I think these deaths surprise people in part because they are accustomed to thinking about people in this age group, more or less 23 to 38, as being in the prime of life, points in their life when they should be their healthiest. And so the idea that you have people in this age group who are increasingly at risk for these deaths is quite surprising and disturbing.
It is. And I read a study recently that looked at how 54% of millennials feel like no one really knows them. And ironically, this is in a generation that's more connected through technology than any previous generation. I mean, we grew up with iPhones in one hand and talking about the internet and all our conversations. And so, you know, perhaps we're losing a little bit of ourself with every selfie. I mean, we're superficially connected, though we're still looking for this sense of belonging, this sense of meaning.
You know, I think you're right. I think it's worth maybe our spending a little bit of time talking about what are those specific challenges that this generation faces. This is the generation that came of age during the Great Recession, and many of them haven't quite recovered in terms of their career trajectory from the consequences of the recession. We know a lot of them are living with education debt, maybe record levels of education debt. A lot of them are living either at the poverty level or near the poverty level. And I think this is a generation that is having a more difficult time finding affordable housing than, say, past generations, say the boomers did.
Absolutely. And affordable housing and affordable health care. In a couple of surveys, they highlighted 61% of folks said they didn't have any money saved for health care expenses. And then in one survey that I saw recently, 64% of folks surveyed said that they avoided or delayed medical care in the last year due to anticipated expenses. I mean, for me, when we look at those economic drivers and whether it's I can't afford my house or I can't afford my care, that puts a lot of pressure on us. And it puts a lot of pressure not only to be able to figure out how to afford, you know, our house or services, but also what do we do when we feel overwhelmed and are in crisis? That's the social drivers here. Things that I think when we discuss policy solutions for drug, alcohol, and suicide, we have to pay attention to.
Another characteristic of this generation is its racial and ethnic diversity. There are a larger percentage of people of color in this generation than in past generations. There are more people that don't speak English. And not only that, there are more people who are openly gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender. And these different populations have different life circumstances, different challenges that they're facing. But when they seek treatment or look for behavioral health services, it really speaks to the need to have culturally competent care, care from providers who either come from those different groups themselves or receive the kind of training so that they know how to provide that culturally competent service to populations that they're serving.
John, that's a really good point. And I think it actually screams for us to call out the need to be attentive to the unique and diverse needs of all our community. And so when we actually look at communities, we know that there are issues of inequity and disparities that are quite profound. And if you just want to give one data point, if we look at adverse childhood experiences, which are experiences that people have in their youth, their adolescence, where they experience some form of trauma, we know that communities of color, whether it's Black, Hispanic, multiracial, they actually have higher exposure to adverse childhood experiences, which means our solutions need to be tailored to take that into account, but also to recognize the unique needs of those communities and how one size fits all is not going to solve this problem.
That makes me think that we probably should shift our focus and talk more about what those solutions are. And as you're thinking about the ways to address these challenges for millennials, what comes to mind in terms of some of the most important parts of that solution?
Well, first of all, I think that people who are going through a crisis or are experiencing some type of immediate problem, they want to seek care. And so I want to talk about this in two different ways. I want to talk about the prevention strategies, but let me talk about the treatment strategies first. So it's a good thing right now. We've seen like 6 in 10 folks reported last year that they're seeking mental health care. We know that people are talking about this more often. We know that the issues of addiction are on the front pages of our newspapers with celebrities discussing this now. We've changed the narrative in part that people are more comfortable here. The problem is that we're still not necessarily getting that care that we want. When people have to wait over a week, and in some cases over 6 months, to get access to mental health and addiction services, one of the solutions that this calls for is for us to more seamlessly integrate mental health and addiction services into the places that people show up. So as we were just discussing, it could be in a prison, it could be in a primary care or pediatric practice, it could be in a school. For heaven's sakes, I mean, it could literally be in the place that you get your haircut. We need to think about how we can diversify those amazingly robust evidence-based services and put them into community. That's number one. Number two, we've also got to be able to think about how to prevent these issues from becoming a problem in the first place. And this is where I know you can go off and tell us 25 different things that we could consider. But really, the dominant public policy conversation right now around these crises focuses on treatment. And that's fine. That's a great place to start. But if we don't begin to address issues around prevention, then John, as much as I love talking to you, we're going to be having the same conversation again in 10 years.
I definitely want to talk to you about both of those things. But let's start with treatment for a minute, because I thought you made really good points. And, you know, one of the things that I think is worth raising about treatment is we don't have universal access to comprehensive health insurance. We've made progress over the last several years, but I think the statistic that I've read most recently is out of the people who are still uninsured, 25% of those are millennials. A lot of the millennials get insurance coverage with their parents through the age of 26, because that was a provision of the Affordable Care Act. And then at 27, they may fall off that cliff and become uninsured. So I think insurance coverage, still got to focus on that. And I think the issue of parity is still a problem, isn't it, Ben? Isn't parity still one of those challenges we're working on, parity in terms of behavioral health?
It is. And for the listeners that aren't familiar with this, mental health parity was a law that was passed over 10 years ago that essentially says that large group health plans, so pretty much everybody in the country that has and that works for somebody is covered by one of these large group health plans, that they have to cover your mental health and substance abuse benefits at the same level as they do medical and surgical benefits. And don't let your eyes glaze over here. This is actually really important, because let's just say, for example, that you wanted to seek care for some type of mental health or substance misuse need. Okay, well, if there's not parity, your payer may limit the number of times you can actually see a licensed professional. That would not be necessarily to your liking or even to help you. I mean, it could actually cause some iatrogenic or negative effects on you. So we've got to be able to enforce this law, the land that's been around for 10 years. And the ways to do that are numerous, but it really starts with states stepping up and enforcing the federal parity law. That's a great one to call out, John. But I have to say, and as we've discussed, even if we just had coverage, we still have to be able to figure out a way to increase our access. And so let's start with coverage. Let's get everybody covered at an adequate level. And then let's figure out a way to increase the ability for folks to gain access to those proper services.
Yeah, I really agree with you. I think one way to focus on access is certainly the screening that you were mentioning earlier. I think it's also doing more to integrate behavioral health into the provision of primary care. I think for a lot of people, they may go to their primary care doctor and they get their physical health needs addressed and never mention anything about substance use or mental health. I think we have to get to a place where those two sectors, the mental health sector, substance abuse sector, are also integrated into primary care. So it's part of routine care to be having that discussion. And if while you're talking to your primary care doctor, you've identified a need, it's more likely that the doctor can walk you down the hall to introduce you to someone who might be able to begin to address those other needs, or if not down the hall, somewhere else easily accessible within the community, instead of feeling like it's really up to the person to navigate to and or three entirely different systems.
Right, because we're at our best when we're in a crisis, right? It's challenging enough in healthcare to navigate the system even when we are healthy, let alone we're experiencing a crisis. As a mentor of mine once said, the triplets separated at birth have always been primary care, mental health, and public health. How do we bring them together in a more seamless way? And to your beautiful point, 96 million Americans had to wait over a week to get access to mental health last year. Referrals are somewhat perpetuating that fragmented approach to delivery, especially around mental health and primary care. We've got to fix that. And the ways to do it, as you said so well, let's take the mental health services, let's infuse them seamlessly within that primary care function so that when you're showing up for your annual wellness visit or you're just kind of showing up because you got the flu and, oh, wait, they're going to ask you about your mood and it turns out that you might have symptoms consistent with depression, there's somebody there to help. It's not about waiting. It's not about letting the symptoms get worse. It's not about hoping everything spontaneously gets better on its own. It's about giving people what they need in those moments that they need it most.
That's a great summary, Ben. And I think it really indicates while there are multiple challenges, there are also multiple solutions. And the report that we've just released gives people the specifics on those solutions. And it's definitely worth diving into those with more detail than we're able to do in this podcast.
John, thanks again for this great discussion. For the listeners that are interested in learning more about our respective organizations or the topic at hand, they can go to Trust for America's Health website at tfah.org, Wellbeing Trust website, wellbeingtrust.org, or the Pain in the Nation website, which is paininthenation.org. Thanks again, John.